Coming up on Simply Superior. If you've ever been called to jury duty, you may have been asked questions about race, even though race isn't allowed as a reason to disqualify jurors.
You cannot discriminate against potential jurors based on race.
We'll talk to experts.
So the question is asking about Black Lives Matter asking about race?
Plus, a composer and professor shares his music with the world from his home in Solent Springs.
From a very young age, I've been producing music from sort of a contemplative perspective. And one of the things that I've written recently was actually a tune for a neighbor of mine who turned 100.
Those stories, plus the news roundup after this. He's a composer of contemplative jazz, and where better to create it than in Solent Springs? Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. That's the music of Ryan Frame, a professor of music at the University of Minnesota Duluth, who's performed around the world and is now quietly composing at his home in Solent Springs. We'll join that Ryan later in the show. But first, a visit with Ryan Reed, the public defender manager for Northern Wisconsin, based in Spooner. It's an encore presentation of a conversation last month that was interrupted by technical difficulties. Here's our conversation. Have you ever been called to jury duty? And do other people in a jury pool look like you or like the people involved in the case? The population of Black, Indigenous, and people of color in Douglas County is about 6%. Yet for myriad reasons, individuals in those groups are disproportionately involved in the criminal justice system. When their day in court comes, will they get a fair trial if members of the jury don't look like them? In Minnesota, race will likely be a central issue in the upcoming jury selection and trial of the four police officers charged with causing or abetting the killing of George Floyd. The process of selecting a jury is called voir dire, French for speak the truth, and that search for truth in seating an impartial jury is key to jury selection. It's often done with questionnaires drafted by lawyers or the trial judge. Some of those ask specific questions about jurors' attitudes on race. But can they really get at the truth, or do they provide a comfortable cover for those who can pretend that race doesn't influence their decisions? Our guest is Ryan Reed, the public defender manager for Northwest Wisconsin.
Welcome to Simply Superior.
Good morning, good morning.
So before we get into the more sensitive questions of voir dire, what are typical questions and what's the basic thing we're looking for?
Yeah, so, public defenders mostly do criminal work. We do some civil things, child protection, termination of parole rights, but, the bread and butter is the criminal work. A lot of the voir dire focuses on, you're trying to bring up themes and issues you think that are very sensitive. So if it's a sexual assault case, you're going to see if the jury has any predispositions towards, sexual assault issues, or has anyone been a victim of sexual assault, or has anyone been a victim of a property crime, if it's a burglary or some kind of crime of that nature. Any connection with law enforcement, any connection with the criminal justice system in general.
Or if you actually know people involved in the case, and I have to interject here because it's for a little bit of levity. I haven't been on too many. Frankly, I only got into one jury pool. And in that one, I was asked, this was in Duluth, so it was on the Minnesota side. And the judge asked me if I knew anyone involved in this case. I said, well, I know you. So he thought that was funny.
Right.
And the whole room kind of laughed and I actually did know somebody involved with that was a civil case, the plaintiff side. I did not last very long in the proceeding, but go ahead.
You're right. So, do you know anyone? Are you related by blood or marriage to any of the plaintiffs or the defendant or the respondent or the judge? The whole point of voir dire is to get a fair and impartial jury. So we want to make sure that the people hearing the case can hear the case fairly for all sides, not just for the defense, not just for the state, And I think the point that you're getting at is how do we get people to really be honest, or how do we get people to you know, reveal what they're really thinking. And it is really hard, you know, on the questionnaires that they send out or, you know, in the actual voir dire process. It really depends on a lot of different factors, who's going to really raise their hand and respond to a question.
One thing about the questionnaire, is that actually given under oath? Or if you're questioned by the judge, and I know it depends on the jurisdiction, some the judges do, some the defense and the prosecution does, and then in federal cases, I think it is usually is the judge. But are those questions being asked under oath, and particularly on the questionnaire?
Not necessarily, because you're just supposed to, you know, in good faith, answer the questions to the best of your ability. You know, there's not a lot of time to kind of go back and say, such and such, such a trial, you said this, but we found information about something different, right?
Mm-hmm. The juror's not at trial, right?
Right, right. And you want to be sensitive because they're doing their civic duty and they're, you know, they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. But it is a good question to really think about, you know, if someone tells you ABC, there's really no way to contradict that. I mean, we do some prior prep for, you know, we run the jury list through our CCAP system. We usually try to do a clear report, look on Facebook, things like that. But for the most part, we just, you know, do they have a prior criminal record? Mm-hmm. What can we draw from where they live or where they're coming from?
I'm just wondering, I saw a set of voir dire questions that actually were from some part of the Wisconsin Public Defender's Office. But one was, what would you do if you heard your child using an ethnic slur? And I'm just wondering if that said under oath, what would you do if you heard your child using an ethnic slur? If I saw those words, would that perhaps make me think twice about my answer?
So let's say the person says, I would, you know, I'd be very mad at my child and that, you know, whatever, you know, talk to them about the racial slur. Mm-hmm. But in a voir dire context, like, what are you learning? What are you really learning about this person based on how they can be fair and impartial for your case? So I guess it's, you know, more case specific of, you know, the details of the case, the race of the defendant, the race of the alleged victims. But I think sometimes in voir dire, we get so bogged down in these, what I can learn from a certain, you know, shade of who someone is. But what do we really learn from that? I guess would be my response.
So the question that frankly got me interested in the whole subject was when I was chosen in the jury pool. It's about as far as I ever got, by the way. I've been called for jury duty several times, but usually it's show up one day, sit in a room, try not to sweat too much, go home, and we'll call you if we need you. You know, so and hey, if that's my civic duties, I'm happy to serve it. But the last time I did get a little bit further, and again, I was in the pool filling out questionnaires, being questioned by a judge. One civil case, one serious criminal case. In both cases, I was not chosen. I was one of two African Americans in the room of about 60, 80 people. I don't know that the other person was chosen either. And race was a factor in the criminal case. So one of the questions was, please describe any experiences you may have had with racism. And, well, for me, they left you two blanks. And I started taking the whole second half of the page and realized I was the last one turning in the questionnaire, which made me feel a little uncomfortable. Is that a reasonable question? Obviously, you're going to get different responses depending on the race of the potential juror.
That was on the Minnesota side, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know necessarily if that's a... Anyone can feel or see or observe racism or experience racism. So I don't think it's just, you know, a monopoly on African-Americans. You know, I guess I struggle with those questions because what are you really learning about this juror? So, you know, if you really filled up that much information that, you know, we can guess that you're maybe a minority and that when you hear certain facts, you're going to be swayed a certain way. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it makes you more open to being struck. I mean, I think any juror that gives information is going to be analyzed by both sides. And maybe that, you know, one side will say, I don't want this juror because they have all this experience. And then, you know, a certain side will say, I really want this juror. And we haven't even really gotten to peremptory strikes, which is the ability to just get rid of a juror for no reason. You know, I just don't like this juror, so I'm going to strike this juror.
Right. And it's important to note that people cannot be capriciously stricken just because of their race, correct? Yeah.
Right. And the case is called Batson, and both sides can't strike someone on the basis of race. But the law also allows, if you have a race-neutral reason, then you can say, well, I'm just striking this person because so-and-so has a criminal record, or so-and-so, has a history of, traffic violations. So they, I didn't strike this guy because he's black, but because he has, prior traffic tickets, which is frustrating because, there's other people on the jury that I knew of that had the same issues, but the state didn't strike them. So,
I could be stricken for my verbosity, right, of filling out two pages for my answer. I can see that. I hate to argue my own other side here, right? But, they could say this guy talks forever, yes.
Well, and that's the thing. Maybe because you're not just controlling, or race isn't just the issue. It's also what kind of makeup is this jury going to be? And so they can judge that you either talk a lot or write a lot. So maybe they don't want you because, you're going to be a big talker and, you have all these racial situations and, let's say, but there's a lot of different factors that go into, I want this juror, or, geez, I got to get rid of this guy or this woman. So,
as far as writing a lot, by the way, there was a fellow juror of mine who said, as soon as I realized who you were, and at that time I was the editor of the Duluth News Tribune, he said, I knew you weren't going to be on this jury.
Right.
And I could have saved my own time if I had thought the same way that juror did. We're speaking with Ryan Reed. He is the public defender manager for Northwest Wisconsin, based in Spooner. And we are talking about jury questionnaires, voir dire, the French word for the process of selecting a jury or searching for the truth. What sort of questions do you ask let me just ask you this. If race is not a factor, if, the person you're defending is not of color and the issue has nothing to do with race, and then what do you ask if race is a factor?
Yeah, I mean, I just, most of my case, all of my cases, really, I focus on the facts. I focus on, what are things that I think if the jury hears about, are they going to be really, not inflamed, but it's really going to be part of our defense. So if it's a self-defense defense, really focusing on, use of force in a situation, or, if it's a bar fight, who's been in a bar fight? Who's experienced this? Who's experienced that? Really talking about the good facts in my case so that I get the jury thinking, okay, this case is about a bar fight, self-defense, defense of others. So is there a girlfriend involved? Is there a boyfriend involved? Wisconsin people like to consume alcoholic beverages. So, who likes to go out, after work? Who likes to go out on the weekend? So really, voir dire is a really great way to kind of plant those seeds, plant those nuggets of information that's going to be good for your case.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's race neutral, I really just really focus on the facts. If race is involved, or I think race is something that's going to come up, asking questions in such a way that's not going to alienate my jury, but also, just being really cognizant of, this situation happened on a reservation. Who's familiar with trying to get at race without saying Native American, without saying African American?
Mm-hmm.
So I've practiced in Brown County, Douglas County, Sawyer County. So most of my jurors have been older Caucasian males and females. So just being very cognizant of, you don't want to turn people off to race, but you have to ask those questions that are going to get at the issue in your case of, this is a Native American person, this is a Hispanic person, or my client speaks Spanish, who has issues or strong feelings towards people that speak Spanish. So
you certainly don't want it to be a surprise when the defendant walks in the room, right?
Right. And in Wisconsin, our voir dire, for the most part, is done in court. So they're going to see my client right away. And one of the questions I typically ask is, who thinks my client's guilty right now? Like right now, who thinks this person did it? Mm-hmm. And you'll have people raise their hands and say, you know what? I do think your client did it. And so it's a really great way to just spark that conversation of, the presumption of innocence, fair trial, due process, and you'll get people, and even if they don't say anything, you can see them nodding their heads. You can see them frowning and making faces. So you're really judging the whole time. Okay, I'm saying this. How are people responding? Probably the most stressful part, for me at least, of the trial, because it's like you just met these people, and now you're trying to make snap judgments on who is going to hear this case for the next 2 or 3 days.
Mm-hmm. I've heard this is also a chance for the lawyers on both sides to, I don't want to say ingratiate, but get chummy with the jurors? So it's the time that you, somebody has an opinion on that.
Here, but, well, I mean, because you have to go with your strengths, right? So I'm not a chummy person in general. So that's not my strong suit.
But we seem to get along, right?
Right. Well, but, you know,
we're not in court, thank you. Let's get to that one, too.
Right. And some people, just their personality is very chummy, and that's not my suit. So I just, you know, and I'm usually last. So I usually try to, you know, ladies and gentlemen, I know most of the good questions are taken. So if you just bear with me. And so, but, you know, but it's a time to put yourself out there, try to be as personable as possible. You know, but I make it about me and my client and really connect the positive vibes I can get from myself, coupled with my client to, you know, make him or her look a little bit better. So.
Mm-hmm. In a place like Northwest Wisconsin, the whole standard is a jury of our peers. And so if there are very few BIPOC people and not in the jury pool, are we really getting a jury of our peers if we're a person of color or indigenous person?
I struggle with that because I agree. I mean, if you know, the statutes and the case law and the, it's a, like you said, it's the county that you're in. So if your county has a lot of people of color, you're going to get a more racially diverse jury. If you're, you know, in Ashland County or Bayfield County or Iron County, you're not going to get a very color diverse group of people. But I also, you know, when we had these conversations, I try to push back against just color as the only diversity that's out there. I mean, I think there's diversity of thought. I think there's diversity of experience, and really trying to pull those different experiences out of your jury to try to work around that. So if you have a person of color that you're defending, what are some ways that this jury that's, you know, in these counties, they're white, older, how are you going to connect with those people, with the person that you're defending? So I think really focusing on what those commonalities are. Mm-hmm. So, you know, farm work, you know, who's done farm work or who's done whatever, or, you know, education, just trying to find commonality.
Right. And, you know, as I think of cases like the officers involved in the George Floyd death, I just wonder what a jury of one's peers is. And there's some talk of relocating the trial, but it still would have to be within Minnesota. And who in the world could not possibly have heard of this case in the world, or at least in the country, let alone Minnesota? So I don't want to fantasize and put myself in a situation ever, but I always thought if there were a large case or some sensational case like this, and, you know, I were the subject, a jury of my peers would certainly include people who would know about it, right? If they didn't know about it, if they were that out of touch, I can't see how that would be called peers.
Well, I agree. I think most people in Minnesota, if not, like you said, the world, have heard of these facts. But are you so involved with the facts and so involved with the protests and so involved with what's going on that you can't be fair and impartial, right? Mm-hmm. So even though, you know, it would be really hard for me to hear that case, you know, I would try to, I probably couldn't hear the case, but I mean, there's going to be 12 people that are going to have to hear that case. And you think you have to figure out, okay, you may know about what happened, but, you know, did you see the video, or, you know, have you followed this since it happened? Did you take part in the I mean, there's definitely lines of questions you can ask to kind of get at not just knowing about it, but have you judged it so much that you can't be fair and impartial?
Right.
I mean, I think that's what the voir dire process is. Like, how do we figure out, so you know, like you said, in this situation, everyone knows.
Right.
But what degree, and can you be fair and impartial to these defendants? Because they deserve a fair trial. Everyone deserves a fair trial.
And, you know, that's one area that I am certainly not looking to volunteer on that jury. But I have to say, of all my peers, if I may use that word again, in the journalism business, very few are saying what we're saying on the show, which is, so we're calling it the officers involved in the death of George Floyd. And I'm hearing news outlets left and right, up and down, and I do mean left and right politically, all saying officers involved in the killing of George Floyd. Well, once you say killing,
right,
that implies a human being did it, and there's nobody else on trial for it. So I'm actually surprised at my peers for using that. And on the other hand, I do say to our audience, no matter how unpopular it may be, do recognize right. that those officers are innocent until proven guilty.
No, and I think you bring up something super important. You know, we're all part of this constitutional framework, right? I mean, the First Amendment is so important to keeping the government accountable. And, you know, what you report, that's what they're going to walk in to the courtroom, you know, in their minds. And I think it is really important, the language we use, because it doesn't have effects.
So, right. We've been speaking with Ryan Reed, the public defender manager for Northwest Wisconsin, based in Spooner. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
So if you can't be stricken from a jury simply because of your race, can you be excluded because of your sympathies for or against an advocacy group that's primarily about race? My next guest is Abby Van Sickle, a reporter for the Pulitzer Prize-winning website on criminal justice, The Marshall Project. She recently wrote about that exact circumstance.
Welcome to Simply Superior, Abby.
Thanks so much for having me.
You recently wrote an article about the voir dire process and race, specifically what can happen if you're selected in the jury pool. And you mentioned your support of a particular organization. What group was that?
In this case, it was Black Lives Matter.
All right. And the details?
Yeah, so this is a California case. There's a woman, her name is Krishala Reed, and she was called to jury duty. And when she arrived at the courthouse in Martinez, California, she was given a questionnaire. And among the questions was whether or not she or any family members supported advocacy groups such as, and then there were a list. One was the ACLU, the National Rifle Association, Blue Lives Matter, and Black Lives Matter. And she wrote, "I support Black Lives Matter." And that turned out to be crucial in jury selection.
And I'm a little surprised to hear the others, too. I suppose that's equal time. What was the case?
The case had nothing to do with Black Lives Matter or any of those organizations, as far as I can tell. It was a double murder that happened in Contra Costa County, which is it's northeast of San Francisco. And there were two people who were killed. This trial happened in 2016, and the case facts were, you know, they weren't related to, you know, to anybody's involvement in a demonstration or a protest, nothing like that.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a matter of a police shooting? I was wondering because it had Blue Lives Matter in there too.
So I'd asked a law professor who has a expertise on at jury selection, is it common that Black Lives Matter would be listed on a jury questionnaire? And as best she could tell, both sides, the prosecutors and the defense, have to agree on the questions that are asked of potential jurors. And so it looks like in this case that there are a couple, you know, like the ACLU and Black Lives Matter that potentially would be more left-leaning, and Blue Lives Matter and the NRA that would be more right-leaning. And so it's sort of half and half.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible that those questions might be okay in one jurisdiction and not another?
So there's a lot of debate around the country about what it means to ask somebody about Black Lives Matter. I've also looked at three other cases, one in Minneapolis, one in Nevada, and one in North Carolina. And all of these cases were trials that reached an appeals court. And so there's actually a record that you can look at about what happened in these cases. And there's a split. You know, they've come on both sides of whether it's okay to ask this or not.
In the Minneapolis one, which is, of course, very germane to us with the trial of the officers involved in the death of George Floyd, that's, you know, likely to come up again.
It was a Minneapolis case. This was a case where in jury selection, the prosecutors asked potential jurors, "Have you participated in any of the Black Lives Matter kind of marches and stuff like that?"
I'm sorry, I have to laugh at that. Doesn't sound very lawyerly, stuff like that. Yes.
Well, you know, in jury selection, actually the lawyers try to talk conversationally with the jurors. Mm-hmm. And so it can sound a little, you know, a little less formal than you might think. But in this case, the appeals court found no racial overtones to that question, that there was, you know, there's nothing about race in asking that question, which is really the key here, is that you cannot discriminate against potential jurors based on race. that is very clear, it's unconstitutional, you cannot do that. And so the question is asking about Black Lives Matter asking about race?
Right. Frankly, I could almost see that it would not necessarily have anything to do with race, particularly in Minneapolis, because if you look at all the protests that have been in the area, they have been very integrated, if not in many cases, majority white.
Well, one thing I think is going to be interesting is in order to get that far, you know, into an appeals court, these cases have been going on for a number of years. And so I think it'll be really interesting going forward now that, you know, there was a New York Times story suggesting that these Black Lives Matter demonstrations around George Floyd's killing have been the largest demonstrations in U.S. history. And so what does that mean? Will this question still be asked?
Or it takes a different context now that the sympathizers of Black Lives Matter are more multicultural than they may have been before.
Yeah, and also that it's a huge movement. And what I've been told is that there's this really wide latitude in what questions can be asked of potential jurors. That this is a lawyers cannot discriminate against jurors by race. However, the questions can delve pretty deep into people's personal experiences.
We've been speaking by phone from Berkeley, California, with Abby Van Sickle, a reporter for the Pulitzer Prize-winning website on criminal justice, The Marshall Project. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the music of Ryan Frame. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Ryan Frain is professor of jazz studies and piano at the University of Minnesota Duluth, where he oversees the jazz studies major and program. He coordinates the annual Head of the Lakes Jazz Festival at UMD, drawing internationally known artists to the area, and in turn performs internationally himself. And closer to home, he's performed with the Green Bay Packers Band and our own local big-time jazz orchestra and scores of other venues, when there's no coronavirus going on. But there is, so he joins us by phone from his home in Solon Springs. Welcome to Simply Superior, Ryan.
Well, thanks, Robin. Thanks for having me.
So since you are at home, are you taking advantage of this as an opportunity perhaps to compose?
Well, that's actually an insightful question because I have been. Not only are we getting our two kids through their school year, you know, we have a 7 and a 10-year-old at home, and we're both teachers, my wife and I, and but it has allowed me some time to be a little bit closer to the piano, just to sit down and do a little writing. So I've been writing a bunch of new material, and that part of this has been kind of a nice change.
And I'm wondering if this is more contemplative work, since, you know, we have plenty of time to contemplate. Or are you imagining those world travels that you're not going on at the moment?
Yeah, definitely more contemplative. I'd say from a very young age, I've been producing music from sort of that contemplative perspective. And one of the things that I've written recently was actually a tune for a neighbor of mine who turned 100. And turns out she was a really great working, jobbing piano player. Dorothy Bouchard turned 100. And actually, there was an article in the paper about this back in February and March. And so I finally got around to writing her tune called Dorothy's Tune. And the story is kind of funny because we had moved into our current house about 6 years ago. And a couple of years after that, these people were moving in next door, and I saw a grand piano getting moved into this house down the street in Solon.
You would notice something like that.
I would. And, of course, the neighbors, new neighbors, came walking by one day, and Roy says to me, you know, how are you? My name's Roy. And he says, yeah, well, we moved down here in part because my mother-in-law is moving in with us. I said, oh, cool. And he goes all on and on about her being this wonderful musician and piano player, and I had known that there was a grand piano moving in there. And he gets through with telling me all about her, and she must have been the workingest piano player in the Twin Ports for many, many years. And he gets to the end of the conversation and says, well, what do you do? It was a really funny, great conversation. So Dorothy and I have become friends as much as we can, although we haven't been able to visit the last few months, keeping everyone safe. So anyhow, I had the opportunity to write this tune for her and honor her 100th birthday. So I tried to think about the types of music that I've heard her play and that we've played together, and think about ways that I've heard other people explain her, such as one of my musician friends who knew her and said, classy woman.
All right, let's take a listen. And that was Dorothy's Tomb by our guest, Ryan Frain, who is speaking to us from his home in Solon Springs. One of your more contemplative works, and another one that I know pretty well. In fact, I know very well because I've been, you were gracious enough to let us use it in our documentary, The Alabama 35. And as a producer, I got to cut it, edit it, and edit it again, and edit it again. Nothing wrong with the piece. It was making a fit in the show, of course. So I know it very well, and of course, it was a joy to use. It really did set the mood for the piece. I'm doing all the talking. I'm setting it up. Let's listen to it. And that was a movement from Four Improvisations by our guest, Ryan Frain. So that's your contemplative side, but that's not your only side, right?
Well, that's right. The record that track is off of is called People We Know. And the funny part about those four improvisations is that they're the only pieces on that recording that weren't written for specific people. It was more of an in-the-moment recording than the other things on that record.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, going back to teaching, how do you teach remotely?
No, that's a great question, and that's one that I asked myself on March, about March 9th. Yeah, and along with so many other people, we tried to put together the best possible solution we could for the time being, right? And what I found, of course, is first having to set up a studio at home that would accomplish that reasonably well, and something where I could communicate and hear students perform and talk with them and also make sure that they had access to things that, you know, normally we don't have the time to deal with. So, of course, the challenge of doing music remotely, you know, there are things that you cannot overcome. Ensemble playing doesn't work real well remotely. Communicating, in the moment as improvisers do, doesn't work real well remotely. However, what my students learned in terms of how to produce music virtually was really something that we don't normally spend enough time on. You know, how to arrange the gear in a way that enables you to produce something that you can publish on the internet. So, you know, people find a way. In the fall, we're looking ahead to, again, for big bands, we're going to be producing some virtual performances and, of course, you know, looking forward to all getting back together at some point. But this is going to help us in some ways. It's not all bad news.
Great. We're speaking again with Ryan Frain, professor of jazz studies and piano at the University of Minnesota Duluth, speaking to us from his home in Solon Springs. I want to go back to a solo. You have a recording called Anthem. We're going to not hear all of it, but I think it will recapitulate a little bit later in the show, and it will be a familiar anthem to people. We won't tell them which one it is, but the okay, you got to be playing it in minor keys. I know that much, right? I mean, it doesn't sound like it normally does.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what. Without it sounds like we don't want to give too much away, but there's a thing that jazz players do called reharmonizations, and it's basically restructuring the harmony under the melody of a tune. This is another one of those that for me, many people are, I know they get frustrated when they hear this particular tune reharmonized or changed in any way, because they feel that it's not, you know, paying homage to the original tune. However, I will let you know that I did this with the utmost respect and tried to reflect a lot of things about
what it stands for, right?
Yes, yeah. The ups and downs of our current situation. And I just kind of threw up a microphone and recorded this last night for your show. But it's not necessarily in a minor key, but everything is reharmonized.
All right. Thank you, Ryan Frain, for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Robin. I certainly appreciate the call and love talking with you anytime we get a chance.
And you're welcome anytime. You can find Ryan's music at ryanfrain.com. That's ryanfrain.com. Here's the beginning of Anthem, and this is Simply Superior. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Hello, Brooks.
Hello.
And our own Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, Danielle Kading. Hi, Danny.
Hi-de-ho, Robin.
Hi. So we're still up in the air with school starting. Both Duluth and Superior school districts have announced hybrid plans. They're a bit complicated, but it seems that some Superior teachers aren't completely happy about it. Danny?
Yeah, the Superior Telegram reported this week that a handful of teachers resigned just before the school year, and that a couple of them resigned over concerns related to COVID-19. You know, they cited concerns for their health or their family's health in making that decision. And, you know, one of them said that the situation right now for teaching is vastly different than when they signed a contract earlier this year, which has sparked a lot of debate over whether or not schools should be taught in person or all online. And Governor Tony Evers has said here in Wisconsin that he has no secret plans to require schools to go all online. But that doesn't mean that Wisconsin Republican lawmakers aren't concerned about that. The Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald has raised concerns about any plans that Evers might have because the governor had previously said he wasn't going to issue a mask mandate, but then ended up doing that. So it's an issue for a lot of schools right now as to whether they should be teaching in person or all online or some sort of hybrid model as the Superior School District has done.
Right. And again, for parents and students and anybody affiliated with the schools, as time gets closer to the opening, you want to pay attention to see what will happen because, as they told us last week, it's all depending on current conditions or current conditions as they will be. And those conditions are maybe getting more severe because we have some new COVID numbers.
Yeah, this week, unfortunately, Wisconsin passed a milestone of 1,000 deaths due to coronavirus. And, you know, the rate of infections and of deaths has increased more recently over the summer months as people have been traveling and experiencing fatigue due to the shutdown. And even the Wall Street Journal referenced northern Wisconsin in a report this week about how rural counties are starting to see higher infection rates of coronavirus as opposed to metropolitan areas in the Midwest now. They cited statistics from Sawyer County, which has seen in the last week or so higher rates of infection than other areas of the state, more urban areas of the state.
Well, speaking of rural areas or definitely far-flung areas on the Minnesota side, Brooks, I understand there's some interesting activities going up near International Falls.
Yes, counterfeit seizures are on the rise up at the border there between Canada and Minnesota, specifically at the rail crossing at Rainier, Minnesota. You know, in the past few years, we've seen about $25 million worth of counterfeit goods getting seized, everything from Barbie dolls to dollar bills, even TVs and fireplaces have been seized recently, and that is expected to continue.
How do you counterfeit a fireplace?
I was wondering that too.
And besides, am I okay with a counterfeit fireplace? I mean, it still burns wood, right?
Right. What it is it's a theft of intellectual property rights, right? So it's using someone else's technology without permission or paying for it, which is what we're seeing in some of these counterfeit Barbies. It's the same sculpt and model of the head, but you're putting it on something that you're selling at the dollar store and not, you know, in the high-priced toy aisle at Target.
All right. Well, I'll tell you, if I'm up in I Falls in January and you've got a counterfeit fireplace, I'm not going to call you in, okay?
Thank you.
Speaking of borders, there's the Duluth Superior crossing with the can of worms, which is a wonderful experience for all of us who drive across it regularly. And it was supposed to be a more wonderful experience with construction happening and finally fixing it to make it a bit safer, but that's not going to happen right away.
Well, some work is continuing, Robin, over the next few years. The Interstate 35 spans and exits are going to be replaced, rebuilt, but a big part of the work is going to get pushed back, specifically on I-535 at the Garfield Avenue interchange, and then the Highway 53 bridge. Both of those projects were postponed due to a $100 million funding gap that was discovered after costs just kept rising and rising with more contaminated sediment and water getting discovered under there. So MnDOT is still moving forward with the $343 million section of this can of worms rebuild, but it's going to be pretty much under the knife for the next decade, just in time for the Blatnik Bridge to be replaced, which is now scheduled to begin perhaps in 2028.
I think the essence of what you said there is seek alternative route, and I think you just sent me on the Bong Bridge. Danny, back on the Superior side, Enbridge, which is not quite the same bridge, right, has issues they've been dealing with property owners on some of the areas where they're envisioning their pipeline.
Right, yeah. Just last Friday, they withdrew their application to qualify for eminent domain with the Public Service Commission in Wisconsin. Basically, they were seeking to condemn private property for their pipeline relocation project for Line 5, and they would have to get approval from state regulators in order to be able to do that. The other option is that they can voluntarily get agreements from landowners, and they say that they have now done that, that they've reached agreements with around 300 landowners to be able to build their preferred route, which runs about 40 miles south of the Bad River Reservation. And as you know, the Bad River Tribe has filed a lawsuit against Enbridge to get them to remove and shut down their pipeline across a 12-mile stretch of their reservation. So that's why Enbridge is pursuing this project, but they still have a long way to go. And there are certainly a lot of residents and landowners and environmental groups that have concerns about this project. So a lot yet to be sorted out with this pipeline relocation project.
All right, and I'm sure it will be. We've been speaking with Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Thank you, Brooks.
Thanks so much, Robin.
You can read the stories by Brooks and the Star Tribune's entire Twin Ports Bureau at www.startribune.com/northreport, and be sure to subscribe to their local newsletter. We've also been joined by my colleague, Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for WPR News. Thank you, Danny.
Thanks, Robin.
And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We leave you with more of the music of Ryan Frayn, 11. Stay safe, everyone.